a lot of developers love SQLite, right? And they use it for to do their integration tests and all of that stuff. Like, I think, you know, we talked about the latency advantages, and I think you made the right sort of connection to sort of developer experience. I think that's why people love SQLite. It's like, you know, there's my database. You know, you don't have to care. I'm so, it will just be there and serve your queries, right?
Welcome to Backend Banter, the show about backend technology and careers. I'm joined today by Pekka Enberg, the CTO of Torso. Welcome, Pekka.
Thanks, Lane. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, super excited. I interviewed Glauber, who is the CEO, about 10 episodes back, where he talked to us about distributed databases and SillaDB. And today, I think we're going to focus a lot more on SQLite and some of the ways that it's kind of changed over the years. Why don't you take just a second and introduce yourself to everyone? Tell us, who is Pekka?
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So I'm Pekka, CTO and founder of Torso. And basically what we do is to bring data where your code is running, or at least as close as possible. And basically the way we do that is with SQLite, and we're doing a bunch of cool stuff to make that happen. So I'm sure we're going to get more into detail about like what we do and why we do it. But that's basically what we're doing.
Amazing. And how long have you been working on Torso?
So the company is 2 years old, actually, in a couple of weeks. For the first year, we work on a different product. And so Torso turns one roughly sometime in December, I think.
You mentioned that your mission with Torso is to bring data close to where company's code is running. Yeah. And a lot of people listening to this might not know exactly what we mean by that. So when you say where your code is running, like, where are you talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. So usually when we talk about this, people don't necessarily know like what the problem is. So you have your data in a database, right? You know, whether it's Postgres, MySQL, it's essentially client server architecture. So you have the data running, or not data running, but data is on a server, database server running somewhere. And then you have your backend code. For example, you write something in Go or TypeScript or whatever. And that's where you do your business logic, right? So what you need to do to access your data, you go over the network to this database server, execute SQL, for example, and get some results back, right? So the issue is that you usually deploy these databases in a cloud environment. And essentially what this means, it's probably going to be somewhere in US East 1. That's where most of people deploy this stuff. But your code could be running, for example, if you use something like Cloudflare, it could be actually running globally, right? So like, I'm based in Helsinki, Finland, so there's actually a data center like 10 kilometers, and you have to do the translation for the people in the US, but it's like, it's super close by, right?
6 miles, and yeah.
And you can imagine that, you know, going from doing your compute in that data center and going all the way to US East 1, you know, to get my data, that's pretty slow, right? So that's the bottom line of why would you need to bring your data closer to, you know, where your compute is. And I don't know if you want to, I'll just let you ask more into.
No, that was a great explanation. So I've got, like, we can just use bootdev as an example, right? Mm-hmm. We've got our server code. So our server application is written in Go. Mm-hmm. It's running, actually, I think, in a data center in Salt Lake. And we have our database. It is a client server model. We're using Postgres at the moment, running like next door. So like, somewhere in the same data center. I don't know if it's in the same building or not. Latency is not like, it's not terrible. It's like on the order of a few milliseconds, I think, but it's still not great, right? Like, it's still measured in milliseconds. So like, humans can kind of tell.
Right? Yeah, that's probably great already, right? But imagine now me using your service. So you have the the code running in Salt Lake or wherever you mentioned it was, right? So for me, it's like 100 milliseconds, 150 milliseconds round trip, right? And so what people are doing, because like, to take a step back, the internet is kind of US-centric still, right? So, you know, when you talk to people who live in the US about, you know, latency problems, they're like, what latency problems? They don't, because like everything is close by. But yeah, actually, if you look at like e-commerce, for example, usually the sort of segment of people you sell to are US, Europe, and even Australia, right? It just forms this one sort of globally reaching area where you know people want to access your site, and they all should have the same kind of a snappy experience, right? So that's why a lot of, especially front-end minded folks have really been doubling down on edge functions and all of that stuff, right? So, and the reason is basically to make the sort of experience of the site super fast and convenient, right? So now you have the issue of, you know, where do I put my data?
So this is all super interesting to me, because I'm actually really new to like the B2C or business to consumer software space. Mm-hmm. So for everyone listening, kind of an overview of what I'm talking about is almost any software company, so a company that ships software as its product, mm-hmm. can kind of be classified as either a business to consumer company or a business to business company. So for example, mm-hmm. boot.dev at the moment is primarily a business to consumer company. We're selling mm-hmm. to individuals, right? Mm-hmm. Whereas actually Torso is kind of a business to business company. You're selling your database technology to other companies. Is that accurate?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
Cool. And the interesting thing, go ahead.
So a lot of individual developers maybe could be considered as consumers in a sense, because like, you know, all the people building their sites, you know, hobby projects, side projects, and so forth. So that's also, I'm not sure if that was something you wanted to get into, but like it also sort of puts some constraints on how we present the product, basically.
Yeah, no, that's true. And that makes a lot of sense. A lot of the cloud providers are technically B2B, but mm-hmm. they have this sales cycle where it's like, you know, you have people trying out your product either as indie or hobby projects, and it kind of grows into maybe business to business contracts. Makes a ton of sense. Bootdev's kind of the same way in the sense that we technically do have business customers. Like we'll have a business that will buy Bootdev licenses for individual developers mm-hmm. at the company. Mm-hmm. But I would say we're primarily B2C, which is a change for me, because most of my career as an engineer, I've worked at B2B SaaS mm-hmm. companies, mm-hmm. like software as a service products. And I would argue if you're working at like a mid-sized B2B company, this whole discussion around like, you know, putting stuff on the edge often mm-hmm. is less important than in the B2C world. In the B2C world, it's like, seems to be much more critically important, because when you're doing e-commerce, you're trying to get people to check out, you need those page loads to be snappy, right? Or you literally start mm-hmm. losing money. And so when I started Bootdev, I built this like very traditional kind of B2B architecture, just because it's what I'm used to. I could spin mm-hmm. it up quickly. And now what I'm finding is like only 35 or 40% of my customers are in the US. And mm-hmm. so anyone outside the US at the moment is getting, I mean, it's not a terrible experience. It's certainly good enough that people are still liking the product and enjoying it, but it's mm-hmm. it's not as snappy and latency is not as low as it is for my customers inside the US. So I'm already looking at ways that I can kind of improve that.
Yeah, and I think that's happening across the board. So latency is like, it's a super interesting topic just on its own. So, you know, a lot of people probably have heard, you know, these magic numbers of 100 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds. Actually, I spent quite a bit of time trying to track out, so to track down, like, where does this come from? Like, why does latency matter, right? And especially in e-commerce, it matters a lot. When, you know, you talk to whoever is in working in e-commerce, they say latency matters. But basically, that, you know, you can think of latency as like a three steps from human perception point of view. And bear with me; it hopefully makes sense in a second. So, like once you cross the 100 millisecond threshold, and this is just like a ballpark number. So actually, anything below 100 milliseconds, humans just perceive as instant, right? You don't notice a delay, right? And once you get to the second mark, 1 second, right? then you know the experience is it feels slow, right? It's not terrible necessarily, but you know you feel that it's slow, and like there's this sliding window from 100 milliseconds to 1 second, and then once you go beyond 10 seconds, you know people it's just you know
unusable.
People might even think that it's just exactly right.
Yeah.
So that's the funny thing about databases, and as I mentioned, you know having the database on a different continent, that's usually already 100 milliseconds round trip, right? So once you add data to the mix, you are sort of, if you were on this 100 millisecond budget, which, you know, not all sites are, but, you know, but it's going to be tough to even get to the 1 second mark if you go back and forth a lot, you know, from your client call to the database.
Okay, I want to repeat that rule of thumb, because I've never heard it put so well and so simply. So
it's not me.
If I'm hearing you right.
yeah. So go ahead. But it's not me. It's like so what I did was, I knew that AWS, for example, had mentioned these things, and Google. So in 2010 or roughly, like in some conferences, and I really drilled down, like, where is these numbers coming from? And this is, I think it's a study from the 1970s or something, which just, you know, gets these ballpark numbers.
Okay, cool. So first of all, when we're talking about latency, we're talking about like how long it takes information to travel, basically, right? Like I'm doing something on my machine. How long is it going to take for the server that I'm interacting with to know about what I'm doing? Or how long is it going to take me to get data back from the server? Is that accurate, roughly?
Well, you can, absolutely. You can make it more generic and just say like, when you observe a reaction to your action. And it's sort of because it, so it also depends on, so latency is it depends on what you're measuring, right? So usually you think about response time, right? And you, or actually if you're doing front-end development, you are thinking of your whole site load and everything is up and running and so forth. But yeah, absolutely what you said is that would be the sort of latency to the database server to get the data.
Right. So like, from like a front-end perspective, I click a link on a website. How long does it take for that page to load, right? How long does it take the server to give me that the front end of the site? And then, you know, our audience is mostly back-end developers. So it's like, okay, once you have the web app in front of you, maybe I click to save my username. How long does it take that request to get back to the database, save the data in the database, and come back and tell the user, you know, everything was saved properly?
Yeah, absolutely.
And I love how you broke it down into these three tiers. So 100 milliseconds, roughly speaking, if your latency is less than 100 milliseconds, which is a tenth of a second, right, 1,000 milliseconds in a second. So 100 milliseconds, then you effectively have like really good latency. It's very low, and people aren't going to be able to perceive, at least not to any detriment, that that this is taking a while. Right.
Exactly.
And then you said 1 second is kind of where it starts to get, how would you describe it? At 1 second, it starts to get clunky. Like people are getting frustrated.
Well, it starts to feel, it starts to feel slow and clumsy, but you probably get already that to like, 500 milliseconds. Like it's just a sliding window, but like 1 second is like after that, you know, it is definitely slow. And you know this from experience as well, right? If you go to a website, like, you know, that 1 second wait, that feels like forever.
Yeah, and then 10 seconds, it's like almost nobody's waiting around for 10 seconds, so they might even just assume that it's broken.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense. And I think especially for people that are new to technology and programming, like just having those kind of like ballpark figures in their head can be really helpful.
And, you know, by the way, so I don't know what, like I love to talk about, latency is one of the the topics I really want, I love to drill into, but like, one thing also, especially if you're new to the field, is to remember is that latency compounds, right? So if you think about a web page and you do something and then an HTTP request goes to your backend service and then that backend service does something, goes to the database. Sometimes you have to go multiple times to the database. So basically this is the user perceived latency is going to be the sum of all of this, right? And there are different ways to mitigate that with parallelization, all of that stuff, right? But like the big thing about latency is that it compounds, right? So it's as good to remember that if your database access, for example, is that 100 milliseconds, that's not the whole thing, right? So that's why it becomes important as well.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought this up. So again, I love using concrete examples. I think it makes it really easy for people to understand what we're talking about. Let's take the example of boot dev. So boot dev, one of the things you do very often is you submit your answer to an assignment. So you write some code, you click submit, and then essentially what happens from a latency perspective is an HTTP request is sent to our backend, which, like, if you're in Utah, maybe it's, I don't know, 50 milliseconds or 20 milliseconds or something. But if you're across the world, maybe it's 300 milliseconds. I don't know, ballpark.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, absolutely.
So that HTTP request is sent. And then the very first thing that happens when that HTTP request gets to our backend is we need to check if you're authenticated. So we like grab your authorization header, and then we go to the database. We do a round trip to the database and we say, hey, database, which is a client server model. So like our server and our database, while in the same data center, are on different machines, right? So there's still a request there being sent. So our server talks out to the database and says, hey, does this user exist? If so, like, do they have the proper permissions, whatever, and gets the user data back. Then it makes another request to the database, right? So this is all still happening since you click the, like, from when you click the submit button. There's the big HTTP request to the server. We go to the database to ask for the user. We go to the database again to ask for the assignment, right? And then we run some logic on the server and say, like, was the assignment correct? And then if it is, it responds in the HTTP request. So you could, like, you could think of that as like three round trip, like, network requests that all had to happen just in the space of like you clicking the button.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, if you want to make it, it's even more complicated than that, right? So because latency is not, it's not constant, right? So I don't know how much we want to get into it, but there's something called tail latency, right? So latency is not a number, it's a distribution, right? So, you know, oftentimes we actually talk about average latency, which is actually just the inverse of your throughput. But basically what it means is that sometimes your latency, so just going over the network, right? So, you know, maybe it's most of the time it's 20 milliseconds or whatnot, right? Sometimes it can be 40 or even that 1 second, right? Because of the, you know, there are routers in between and all of that stuff. But it actually sort of, you can drill down all the way to the operating system, right? And there will be these sources of variability in latency, right? So it's so what you just explained is 100% correct, but it's even worse, right? Because if you increase the loads in the system and all of that stuff, right, it becomes, and that's why latency is such a fascinating topic to optimize for, right? Because I don't know if you can ever win, right?
Right. You know, you can make it better in the average case or whatever. Yeah. No, that makes sense. Yeah. So I want to talk about and kind of, you know, have you answer some questions now about SQLite, because I know, so like, first of all, you know, let's just reiterate something. So most applications out there, or I don't know if this is actually accurate, but, you know, most web applications that I've worked on follow this client server model. Like, I have my server, which is my backend code, and then I have my database server, which is like a separate server. It's like Amazon RDS or Google Cloud SQL or whatever. And there's a client server model in that relationship, in the sense that my web server is actually acting as a client to the database server, and there's latency between them. When we teach SQL on boot dev, our SQL course actually is using SQLite on the back end. So we're running your code against an SQLite database. And several times in the course, we mentioned how, like, you know, SQL is a language that applies to like all these databases. We happen to use SQLite to power this course. What's the difference? What makes SQLite different in that model from like a traditional Postgres or MySQL or Oracle or whatever?
Yeah, so SQLite is an embedded database, or you could, you know, a database library. So what you do with SQLite is you put it inside your application, right? So to zoom out, as you said, like, SQL is a language and it applies to a lot of systems. But typically the way you use SQL is actually remote execution, right? So you have the, you know, and, you know, most people will know that, you know, if you want to use Postgres, for example, you need the Postgres drivers, right? And essentially what and you use those drivers in your backend code, for example. And basically what the driver just does is it provides you this illusion that you are running, like you can just execute SQL, but it's actually running on a different machine. And this is a really typical architecture. So SQLite is it's a different type of architecture where there is no server, right? You just have the database, so the relational database engine running in your application. And basically what this gives you is, insanely fast reads in comparison to going over the network, right? Because network latency is always going to, even in a data center, like it's going to be in the milliseconds almost certainly. And when you're reading, because what SQLite lets you do is essentially you are reading from your main memory, right? So we're talking about hundreds of nanoseconds. Depending on what kind of a query you have, right? But it's a different order of magnitude in terms of latency.
Yeah. And it's like, whenever I'm debugging data-related issues, especially data-related issues revolving around speed, I'm always really asking like two questions first. The first is like, okay, so I've got like, sorry, let me rewind back to like the beginning of like how you would look at this through the lens of a backend developer. Usually what will happen is like the user's doing something on the page and it's slow. And like that's how you get notified as a developer, right? Is like user's doing something, it's like way too slow. They go submit a support request or tell someone on the team, somehow this data gets back to you and you have to go find out like which of the endpoints on your server or which of the HTTP handlers is like taking a long time. So you go like dig through logs, look at telemetry, and you find, oh, like this endpoint on average, or maybe in this customer's case, is taking 1 second or 5 seconds or 10 seconds, or God forbid, I've seen like we had at one company I worked with, there was like a really bad endpoint that in certain edge cases could take like 120 seconds to return.
Yes.
Which was crazy, right? And like once you find that out, now it's like, okay, what's going on in this endpoint and what's taking the time? And usually in my experience, if it's like a medium amount of time, like it's just kind of annoying, then oftentimes what's happening is this thing that we've been describing, which is like there's many database requests happening like one after the other. So it's like I send one request and I wait, and then I send another request and I wait, I send another request and I wait. The other thing that can happen, there's lots of things, but like I would argue the second most common thing is just that the query that you're running against the database is a really slow query for whatever reason. Like you're querying against a massive amount of data, or you're doing a bunch of joins, or maybe a column isn't indexed. So if I'm hearing you right, like embedding SQLite in my database as a backend developer is primarily to solve the first problem, the like latency problem of I'm doing many queries like one after the other, because now my database is inside of my application on the same machine rather than existing, outside where I would need to make network requests.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's 100% right. And so actually SQL, the second problem of a slow query, you probably need indexes. So that's the first thing. But it's basically that, what you expressed in SQL just has to go through a lot of data, right? So actually, databases like Postgres or MySQL are probably more efficient and better optimized in terms of this kind of a query planning thing. So SQLite is actually, it's kind of simple. So SQLite is super funny because it's kind of simple, but it's also super powerful, right? So for the second kind of problem, I would expect something like Postgres to do way better job at, optimizing these super complex queries. Of course, the trick is that you don't, you probably don't want to do them. But yeah, so the first part is really like that's where if you think about your backend service and you mentioned like the authentication thing and then actually doing getting the data that you were actually interested in, like that's a super common problem, right? And there is no like you can't there's no way around the network latency. So for those kind of use cases, SQLite is super great. But also, so I think it's also maybe worth mentioning that SQLite was really designed for a different type of use case where you have embedded applications like all these infotainment stuff and all of those kinds of things where you just want a database and you actually are on a single machine.
So you're talking about like a database that runs locally in like a mobile app or something like that.
That's a big use case for SQLite, definitely, absolutely.
And you're saying those are like use cases that it's used for currently. And if I'm understanding right, you guys are essentially trying to push it outside of just that traditional use case and get it used more kind of server side in web applications, especially web applications that are like becoming globally distributed.
Yeah, exactly. So I mentioned that the example of using something like Cloudflare. So edge functions is more or less the general term. So I think it's worth maybe just briefly touching on like the topic of Cloudflare workers specific or the model. There are other platforms as well. They're just one of the more popular ones. But basically, what you get with something like Cloudflare workers is that you you write these functions. So an HTTP request handler, for example, you write them in JavaScript, or you can use WebAssembly as well. And when you deploy to Cloudflare Workers platform, they actually put it on all of the locations that they have. And I think they have like 200-300 different locations. And like from my perspective, they have one close by to me. So now you basically are able, or depending on where your user comes from, they will be routed to the closest by data center, and that's where this compute is going to happen. And now, how do you bring SQLite to the party, right? Because it is basically tied to a single machine. So you have basically two approaches. One of them is you would integrate SQLite into the runtime. So all the functions, serverless functions that you write, they execute on some runtime, like V8, which is what Node, for example, uses. So you could do that. But if you want the data in multiple locations, you still have the issue of how do I replicate to multiple locations? But also because like when we started out, we didn't really have the opportunity to go to Cloudflare and, hey, can we hack your runtime? So basically what we did is the next best thing. And, it's still network. So SQLite is tied to a single machine, but what we did is added a server mode. So you can remotely execute SQLite over HTTP. And actually this works pretty great because what you can do is actually provision these small database servers super close by to the different Cloudflare locations, for example. And now you can globally get, regardless where your user actually yes, they will be routed to the closest by Cloudflare location, and then the database is going to be 10 milliseconds, 20 milliseconds from you. So that's one thing which we built purely because like you need this thing to make SQLite useful in the serverless context.
Okay, right. So let me like play that back and make sure I understood what I'm hearing. So my initial, based on the discussion we've had so far, my initial guess would have been that, okay, if I have a server that I'm, like you said, deploying all around the world. So let's use the example of Cloudflare workers. Mm-hmm. And we'll contrast it with Bootdev again, because I think it'll provide a good example. So mm-hmm. when I deploy my server side code in Bootdev, it mm-hmm. a copy of my code gets pushed up to the data center in Salt Lake, and then everyone around the world makes requests to that data center when they want to interact mm-hmm. with my backend. Mm-hmm. Whereas with a more serverless edge function route, like if we go that architecture, mm-hmm. then what happens is my backend code is actually pushed out to 300 data centers all around the world. Mm-hmm. There's mm-hmm. one in Australia. There's probably three in Australia and five yes. in Europe and 10 in mm-hmm. the US, right? They're all over the place. And that means that my customers, wherever they are now very close to a copy of my backend mm-hmm. code. So they can, mm-hmm. they can interact with that server, very quickly. The problem is, of course, if you do that and you don't distribute your database, mm-hmm. then the customer is going to interact with the server that's very close, but then that server is going to make a huge request over to the database server that's still in Salt Lake or something like that, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And also just to provide a little more context, interesting thing about boot dev is we recently migrated to Nuxt.js, not Next, mm-hmm. but Nuxt, the Vue mm-hmm. one. And we have, so we have like our front end back end, our back end mm-hmm. for the front end. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And that actually does run serverless all across the world. But our back end, like the API that, that sits in front of the database, that is still just in Salt Lake. So people get like really fast page loads on for like the front end. But then when they want to interact with our back end, they're still making requests to Salt Lake. Okay, so you've got your backend distributed, let's just say. You've done this like Cloudflare worker thing. Mm-hmm. My initial gut reaction to what we've been talking about is like, okay, Torso probably embedded SQLite in the runtime. Like you said, like if you're using Node.js on the backend, then they just embedded it straight into like, you know, whatever environment exists there that's executing the JavaScript. Mm-hmm. We use Go, but I imagine like the same idea, you could embed either the SQLite database into the compiled Go binary, or it could just live there on the same machine. But what you're saying is you didn't do that. Instead, you took the SQLite database and you distributed it everywhere across the world. Mm-hmm. And now my server just happens to be pretty damn close, right? So like I've got a server in Australia. I also happen to have a Torso database in Australia that's running SQLite. And you said you essentially had to, hack is probably a disingenuous term, but like you had to change or update SQLite to allow it to work in this client server model. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I have nothing against good hacks. So when we started out, December last year, roughly. What we actually wanted to initially do is to just take SQLite and take that embeddability. So I think it's maybe it's worth sort of reminding ourselves that in a serverless context, you write your application code, and you probably don't write everything. Like it's probably just fragments of your application, but you write this logic and you deploy it everywhere, but that's stateless, right? So from an application developer perspective, there is no state, right? So unless you are the provider, there's no way, you just don't have the ability to retain that state. So that's why we did that, decided, okay, we're going to go with this HTTP route. But it's not that we didn't want to do the embedded thing, and that's actually something we are releasing now. It's essentially embedded replicas, right? So this, well, but maybe we would need to talk about replication first. But basically what we are also going to give is essentially you embed libsql, which is our fork of SQLite. You embed it into your application, and now your application can become a full replica. So that's definitely something that's important. But like, for the serverless context, it makes less sense, again, unless you're the provider, where you could integrate libsql embedded replicas into the runtime itself. But there's other ways to get your code distributed. So Cloudflare Workers is an example of this serverless approach, but you have, for example, Fly, which just gives you machines. And actually, we run Torso on Fly, and now you have like 30 to 33 different locations across the world, and these are just machines or fractional machines typically. But so yeah, in that kind of, if you run your backend on Fly, for example, then embedded replica starts to make tons of sense, because you have the storage there where to put the data into.
Okay, this is really cool. Like I've said, I'm looking at how we can, so like we just migrated to Nuxt like last week, mm-hmm. From a standard like Vue SPA, and a big reason behind that was performance in places around the world, right? Mm-hmm. Now you can get like a full page load with most of the data there. Mm-hmm. It was like cached, mm-hmm. whereas before you had to always reach out to the database. And kind of the next step that probably won't be happening like this year, but hopefully next year, mm-hmm. is I'll be looking at how we can distribute our database so that, you know, customers around the world have even faster, load times and performance, mm-hmm. things like that. What you just said about replication is really interesting to me. Because, and I want to, again, just play it back to make sure I'm understanding correctly. So mm-hmm. the current kind of model, if I'm going to use Torso, is that I distribute my data backend, so like my Go API, mm-hmm. Serverless, right? It's like serverless functions around the world using a product like, I don't know, Cloudflare Workers or AWS Lambda or whatever. Mm-hmm. I've got that code everywhere. And kind of the current torso model is, now I'm going to put my data, I'm going to take that and replicate it everywhere across the globe in SQLite databases that are like very close to the Cloudflare workers or Lambda functions. But now what you're saying is I can get an additional replica of the data within my Lambda functions. And you said it can't be like too serverless in order for this to work. I'm guessing because what that means is every time I invoke the function, it's going to like delete the database and have to like resync it. Is that why?
So that's exactly right. So actually, we had a prototype of something like this, or basically running SQLite on AWS Lambda. But the issue is, so again, it goes back to the whole question around storage. So AWS Lambda is actually kind of feature packed, right? There is storage, but you don't really have, so they have this 100 megabytes, I think they bumped it up to a gigabyte or something, of storage actually on a file system, but it can go away, right? And you don't really control when it goes away because, like, and I'm not an expert on how AWS Lambda works internally.
That's abstracted away from you as a developer. Yeah, but it just kind of goes away sometimes.
Yeah, but what happens is, you know, my best guess is that they recycle the functions, right? Because it's like it's supposed to be a transient storage, just for something to use for just a little while, right? So now you have this issue. Let's say that you have you used up the 100 megabytes to keep a copy of your database. So when it goes away, and this goes to, you know, we talked about tail latency before, to synchronize that database, you know, now some of your requests would take really long time. Plus, it's not clear to me if you can actually even know that your database got wiped out or if you don't have a database, right? So even for AWS Lambda, we'd still almost certainly recommend to use the HTTP access method. But if you get some, you know, if you use something like Fly, or if you're actually deploying on EC2, where you have, like, where you know that I'm going to have this durable storage, then it starts to make sense. Well, it doesn't have to be actually durable, because it's fine if you lose it, you can just replicate it again. But like something that you control over, and something you don't have to, you know, worry about the replication. So because if you just take the whole machine down, that's fine. Like that's completely fine.
To be clear, when you say tail latency, you're talking about like the worst case latency. So like what the customer who like happens to make the request when the durable storage goes away, like how long their request is going to take.
Yeah, I should have been more specific. So when I mentioned earlier that the latency is distribution, so tail latency is the tail of the distribution. So the 99%, well, actually 99 percentile happens quite often. I don't remember the maths, but you know, with enough people, like a lot of people are going to experience it. So usually you have like you know, 99.99 percentile or something like that. But yeah, so the extreme slow part of your latency distribution. Yeah.
So like in statistics speak, you've got like a bell curve of all the requests that are going to your server, and you kind of lay them out in this bell curve. And you're talking about just that little corner of the bell curve that has like all the slowest requests. We don't want those to be too bad, because it's like you can have great average latency, but if one out of every 100 customers gets a 10 second load, they're just going to think your app is shit, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing. So, you know, synchronizing 100 megabytes of database, like it's not, you know, it's not going to take minutes, like it's going to be a couple of seconds, right? But somebody's going to experience that. Plus, you have no control over it. Plus, latency compounds, right? So, you know, all of these factors come into play, and it's, you know, it's not going to give a great customer experience for sure. So that's like one of the reasons why we didn't. Like, we're definitely going back to AWS Lambda and look into ways if we could, because like I guess I'm starting to get a little bit greedy, but from my perspective, if there's some storage somewhere, like we would love to replicate that. That's the whole thing, I think, with SQLite is like wherever you, like whatever place is the closest, you know, that has a little bit of storage that you have control over, you can almost certainly get SQLite running there.
Yeah. It's, So like going back to the tail latency, like Murphy's Law says your one request out of 100 that takes 3 seconds, it will be your most expensive customer.
Yeah.
Be like your best customer is going to be the one that gets that and mm-hmm. threatens to cancel because your app is unusable.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Cool. Okay. So when we're talking about, so I think I'm understanding this kind of new replication model that you guys are working on where you're still distributing like the almost the source database lives somewhere, and then you've got replications all around the world, and then you've got replications of those replications potentially running in the server itself. And that would mm-hmm. obviously reduce latency a mm-hmm. ton. Mm-hmm. Talk to me a little bit about the difference between this paradigm and what I could get from like Planet Scale with MySQL. I recently had Brian Morrison from the Planet Scale team on the show. I think it was 3 or 4 episodes back mm-hmm. to talk about how they distribute MySQL, you know, mm-hmm. kind of geographically and how you could get it working with your database. But MySQL is a very different database than SQLite. Mm-hmm. Right. What are some of the trade-offs that, you know, a back-end developer who's trying to decide which paradigm is better for their app? What are some of the trade-offs that you make when you choose MySQL versus SQLite for this kind of distribution problem?
Yeah. So, not an expert on. So, PlanetScale uses a layer called Vitess, which does the distribution, and I think they do sharding. Basically, it's like a layer on top, which lets you have lots of MySQL servers running. I would go thinking from your application perspective, I think the first question you should ask if you're fine with the client server model, right? Because that's with Planet Scale, for example, or MySQL, you know, that's still the case. And, you know, if that's something that you know, you don't really have a problem with, then, you know, you can probably, use MySQL, you know, and it's going to be fine. But for SQLite specifically, what you can get rid of is this client server model. So now you can do more, you know, ad hoc queries. I think it's maybe the question to ask is like, how much time are you willing to spend on minimizing the round trips to your database, right? I think that's maybe one thing to consider. And like, we, for example, are actually so Turso is two parts. It's the fork of SQLite and all of this stuff that we talk about, but it's also a platform like to provision the databases and have all the users and all the databases and all that stuff. It all actually runs on SQLite, right? So, like, you could flip the question around. It's like, when are you going to need MySQL? And, you know, there's tons of applications that absolutely do, right? But oftentimes when you just need a database, SQLite is super great for that, right?
I want to, like, start giving some, like, hand-wavy kind of heuristics or, you know, things that can kind of guide you as you're, like, trying to decide when X would be better than Y. And, mm-hmm. and obviously there's always specifics and you always need to dig into like the specific use cases of your own application. But I think a lot of times we can kind of come up with some hand wavy guidelines that'll help us decide mm-hmm. things. And what it sounds like to me, and again, try to correct me if you think I'm wrong or if I'm misunderstanding, but that going the SQLite route really optimizes for the latency side of the equation. Right, like getting like you can do 100 reads to your database in a single HTTP request if your database is in your application. Like, it's just not really a problem. And mm-hmm. the benefit to me of that, I mean, there's several. The first is just that, like, you can kind of forget about the round trip latency between your server mm-hmm. and your database if you've embedded the database. But like, there's kind of a developer productivity argument to be made there in the sense that, like, a lot of times when you're trying to write like really simple back-end code that just like gets the job done, it's easier to write the code in a way that does these synchronous mm-hmm. database like lookups, right? It's like, just give me the user. Okay, now that I have the user, just give me the thing I care about next and give me the thing I care about next. Whereas mm-hmm. like, if you're trying to optimize for like sending very few queries, you kind of have to write mm-hmm. these very custom large SQL queries with like lots of joins and asking for exactly the right information so that you can kind of jam all the data that you need into one SQL mm-hmm. query. So it's like a developer productivity standpoint, but really it's all about, yeah, like not caring about the latency. Whereas like going down the MySQL route, in my mind, it's like, okay, maybe the latency isn't such a problem. Maybe you've already optimized the SQL queries, mm-hmm. or maybe it's mm-hmm. not a problem that, like, you just have developers that love writing big SQL queries. I don't know. but like, that's not the problem you're necessarily trying to solve as much. And you're more concerned about like, okay, I actually have like a ton of data, like billions of rows or something. And I need all that data to like be in sync. Am I mm-hmm. kind of making sense here?
Yeah, I think you are. But you know, I have to, you know, the disclaimer here is that, you know, you should never take any advice from database vendors, and you know, I represent one here.
Well, you have to represent the SQLite case, because I already had PlanetScale case for
yeah, absolutely. But I think for SQLite, so like a lot of developers love SQLite, right? And they use it for to do their integration tests and all of that stuff. Like, I think, you know, we talked about the latency advantages, and I think you made the right sort of connection to sort of developer experience. I think that's why people love SQLite. It's like, you know, there's my database, you know, you don't have to care. It will just be there and serve your queries, right? So like from my perspective, and it was actually I've never really run SQLite in production before, you know, we started to do the Turso backend. And actually sort of the founding story of the whole Turso thing is that, you know, when we were working on the previous product, you know, we were using SQLite for the local development experience, right? And then we just assumed that for production use, we're just going to use one of these big brand distributed SQL databases, not naming any names. And it didn't work out, right? Because it was expensive, slow, hard to replicate. It just didn't fit the model of, you know, what we wanted to do. Like I wanted to do this global deployments type of feature, like something like Cloudflare Workers, right? It just didn't work out. So like now thinking, like I would just, like whenever I'm doing something, I just start with SQLite because it is, and especially with Turso, because you can now run it in production. And I think a lot of those things which you mentioned also, like related to data volumes and stuff like that, I think that is literally when you are starting to outgrow SQLite. But I think, and it makes tons of sense. And, you know, PlanetScale, for example, it's built for the GitHub scales and all of that stuff, right? And there's, you know, definitely, you know, applications like that. But I think people might not necessarily know that SQLite is actually, like, it can do hundreds of thousands of queries per second on your machine, right? And now with this read replication, you know, it scales up. Writes are still, by the way, something that SQLite struggles a bit, unless you do sharding, for example. So like, I'm not gonna say that it's perfect for all the use cases, but I think SQLite is a super great database for starting out and actually going to production and going quite far.
I'm a huge fan of this kind of approach to engineering a new product. And frankly, like as a junior developer, you probably won't need to make these types of architectural decisions as often. It depends. Mm-hmm. Maybe you will. Mm-hmm. Like if you get hired at a really small company. Mm-hmm. But this approach of like, okay, we're going to do the simplest thing that will like work for the next order of magnitude, right? So we mm-hmm. we have like, I don't know, a gigabyte of data. Like we're just going to plan for the next 10 gigs, which mm-hmm. like we anticipate will be like a year, like get us a year or 18 months down the road. And then you can kind of attack the next problem when you get there, right? It's the classic, like you don't want to over-optimize. So I love the idea of like, yeah, like SQLite can take you surprisingly far these days, mm-hmm. is kind of what I'm hearing. Whereas like maybe 15 years ago, everybody was like, SQLite's a toy. You would never use it in production. That's crazy. Mm-hmm. Where it's like, okay, maybe now like hardware is just to the point where it actually can get you, you know, quite a bit down the road. Is there a heuristic for like how much data you can store in a SQLite database before it just stops being the right tool for the job? Is it, you know, 1 gig, 10 gigs, 100 gigs, a terabyte? Like where does it stop making sense?
So I think practically speaking, probably 100 gigs is a good, sort of threshold for this. But the thing is that I think SQLite and the stuff that we're doing, it's always going to be great for smaller databases. And that's also something that we are releasing as well, is have multi-tenancy essentially, right? So because that's also something like, databases a lot of times people think about databases as this one gigantic thing that just has all of your data, and there's a place for that as well. So actually, like, so the way I see is that the Turso, for example, is great for slices of your data. So I, you know, I, maybe I should sort of elaborate on that a bit. So because what you are essentially doing with Cloudflare for Workers, for example, is having that logic that is specific to your customers, for example. So personalization, close to them, right? Because all of the other stuff, you can just cache the assets and all of that. So you just want some custom logic related to your customer close by, right? So naturally, what you probably want to do is get a small slice of data that is relevant to that customer or the customers in that region and just have that replicated close by, right? And then you're almost certainly never going above even the gigabyte limit, right? So that is also something which I think really plays to the strengths of SQLite. But to, you know, just to answer your question, you can probably get a 100 gig SQLite and it's going to be fine. I don't know where the exact, like I keep hearing anecdotes, right? I'd never measured myself. Like, you know, once you get to the hundreds of gigs, it supposedly gets slower, and then terabyte probably, you know, but then you almost certainly have to rethink what you're doing. Like, because that's a great sort of use case for, you know, one of these more traditional database solutions.
Yeah. So as we're talking, I just pulled up my production database for Boot Dev in Google Cloud SQL to take a look at where I'm at. Just because I want to give people just kind of a, again, just like an idea of like the scale of this data that we're talking about. Mm-hmm. So we currently have a little over 60,000 registered users on boot.dev. Mm-hmm. And all of the users have, you know, some amount of like exercise completions. And like that, frankly, that is most of the data in our database. It's users, mm-hmm. information about users, and like information about the lessons that they've completed. Mm-hmm. Fairly simple data model. With 60,000 users, we currently, our entire database is taking up 0.55 gigabytes. So 550 megabytes, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. right? And so, like, based on what I'm hearing, we could 100x and probably still be safe in SQLite, which is pretty cool to hear. Because, yeah, like, we're absolutely not, like, tiny anymore. I mean, 60,000 registered users is, like, that's a good amount.
Yeah, that was actually a big adjustment. So, you know, in the past, I worked at a company called ScyllaDB, which is essentially a Apache Cassandra-compatible distributed database system. And you know, I don't, maybe you talked about this with Glauber as well when he appeared on the podcast. But, like, we were used to terabyte was a small data set, and, you know, petabytes and all that stuff. So that's actually something we learned quite early on. Like, we were talking to people, you know, and they mentioned they have a large database, and then we're like, so, you know, how big? And then a gigabyte, and then, like, and it's a big database. Like, it's like for those use cases, it is a big database, right? But it's an adjustment in terms of, you know, what you consider big and you know, whatnot. So, like, from the way we think about things is, like, gigabyte is probably, you know, not small, but like medium. Then if you get to tens of gigabytes, then that's already on the larger side. And then over 100, it's like a huge database, right? That's one way to think about SQLite, I think.
I also want to point out, it's so important to understand that, like, data in a company usually is correlated to something, but it's not always users. So, mm-hmm. like, for example, on Boot Dev, it is users. It's users and how much those users are, like, getting through the program, right? Like, mm-hmm. how far they're getting into the program, how many exercise completions they're logging, how many quests they unlock and achievements they get, right? So we kind of have, like, okay, the average user gets this far into the course within this amount of time, and, like, we have our total number of users. We can do, like, a calculus to figure out kind of mm-hmm. how much data we need. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, companies I've worked at in the past, these B2B companies that were more, like, marketing analytics platforms, mm-hmm. we didn't have 60,000 users. Mm-hmm. Like, we had much fewer users, but these companies were actually much bigger in terms of how much revenue they made because their customers were much larger, right? So when, for example, Amazon's a customer, they might only have like 10 people from their marketing department as users, but just for Amazon, you might be storing a terabyte of data, mm-hmm. right? Because you're ingesting like all this marketing data and you're trying to do analytics on it. So it's really important to understand as a backend developer that the company you work for, like, their storage or database size is probably correlated to something, like one or two things. It's probably a pretty simple thing that it's correlated to, but mm-hmm. everyone always assumes that it's users. It's not always users.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so there was actually a great, I had a conversation with someone, I think from AdTech, and you know, we were having the same kind of discussion, obviously, like the database sizes and so forth, right? And then like the architecture that they have is like they have petabytes or maybe hundreds of terabytes, but not lots and lots of data in the main database, right? And then what they do is they run all of this stuff through some machine learning models, right? And out pops databases that are the data sets which are in the 100Ks or megabytes, right? So that's a really typical. So one way to also maybe, as a backend developer to think about things is that you have the data pipeline, like you have the Kafkas and Red Pandas streaming in data, you have, these really large Postgres installations, for example, where you keep all of your data, right? But then to take advantage of that data, like, usually the data sets are much smaller. That's also something, even if you have lots and lots of data, your application almost certainly is never gonna go through all of it, except for analytics. So that's also maybe good to mention. SQLite is an OLTP, so online transaction processing, which just means transactional data like orders or users and their assignments they did. And then OLAP, which is online analytics processing, is literally about I have this gigantic data set, I want to answer some specific question, I'm going to run through all of the data, right? And DuckDB, for example, is the SQLite equivalent in that space.
Okay, this transitions into two questions that I'm really excited to get an answer to. The first one is, let me again just give an example. Bootdev continues to be a great example, I think. So we have this transactional data, right? Mm-hmm. User signs up. Boom, we create a transaction in the database. We've got a new user record, right? Mm-hmm. Got their email, we got their username, whatever. User completes an assignment. Boom, transactional record. We log that in our database that they completed an assignment or they mm-hmm. unlocked an achievement or they completed a quest or they earned some gems, whatever. Like very transactional things, right?
Yes.
Those are just like CRUD operations. Create a thing, read a thing, no big deal. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. SQLite's great for that.
Mm-hmm.
We have a leaderboard. mm-hmm. Right, where we want to be able to say, okay, for today or for the last week, here mm-hmm. are the top 16 users by assignments completed or by gems earned. That might not be what SQLite is built for.
Well, it depends. Like, so depends on how large the data set actually is.
Let's assume scale. We're successful. We're the largest ed tech company in the world.
Also, do you need to be it to be real time all the time? Like typically, so
SQL, real time. 100%.
So, yeah, you want to be real time as well. So SQLite is probably not the thing to use because like what you essentially want. So, just going to the analytics sides of things, like the cool things that they are doing is essentially laying out the data in a way and compressing it in a way where you actually, like, you sort of cheat, right? Because you have all the data laid out in this optimal way. And now to answer your question, like, it's super fast to run through it, right? So what SQLite, for example, has to do, it has all the data organized in this B-tree, has to traverse through the B-tree, so that's the main difference. So again, I would probably still use SQLite for the leaderboard and probably just cache the result, right? Or do it batch, do it in a batch like once a day, right? But yeah, so basically that's the main difference. Like with analytics, they're really you're optimizing for this. If SQLite had insanely fast reads, then I don't know what is even more insane than you said. But like it's on a different level, and there are actually nice benchmarks showing differences between DuckDB and SQLite, for example, for this analytics load. Like it's super hard to beat DuckDB type of. We can get into detail. I don't know if it makes sense, but like the way they organize data internally is just completely different. But also what it does is it's more difficult to do these ad hoc queries as well.
Right. Yeah, that's kind of what I'm trying to maybe coax the difference out of is like, for example, in the past, I've used this model where like we were using Postgres mm-hmm. for like transactional data, and then we would mm-hmm. kind of log a copy of like just everything that happened, almost like event logs, to like Elasticsearch.
Yes.
And then we would use Elasticsearch to do like really flexible queries into that data without necessarily having to change the structure of the data too much. And it was more of like an analytical type of query that we were
Running. Yeah, I think it is. Well, it's search, so that's maybe a third category, or depending on...
To be fair, we actually weren't using it for search as much as we were for like aggregations.
Well, that's analytics. That would be analytics, definitely.
Yeah. Okay, cool. The other question that kind of arose in my head out of this is like, so you mentioned like 100 gigabytes might be like a good benchmark. Again, not like a hard number, hard rule, but like a good benchmark for when you might be starting to outgrow SQLite. The question I had is like, that makes sense to me, especially like in an embedded scenario where like I've got the database embedded in my application, got 100 gigs, no problem. Does it pose a problem for like replication? So like if I have a 100 gigabyte database running on Torso, is it going to take a lot longer to get that data replicated out to all the edge locations? And do I need to consider anything there?
Basically, it's more about the initial bootstrap, right? So it's the same problem when we talked about AWS Lambda, right? So, you know, if I have 100 gigs of data, then, you know, it's going to take a while to get it over to the network, right? So when you create new replicas to different locations, then, you know, it will take a while for that replica to come back up, right? But after
that, like 5 minutes, a day, a week?
No, so I would expect 100 gigs to be like, a minute or something. Maybe somebody now does the, while
it's
listening
less than
to
DNS
this,
propagation. That's fine.
No, but it's like, but it's not like, even 100 gigs is not that much data, right? It's a lot, but it's not that much, right? So, and again, it depends on the network. But one thing to really remember is like, for example, with Torso, these are essentially data center locations, and Fly is providing the sort of backbone between the data centers and so forth. So it's not like it's going over your wireless router and all the stuff. So there should be bandwidth available, right? But after that, it's basically what you are replicating is the changes, right? So that's the thing where we build, and you know, we're not the only ones. There's LightFS, for example, doing something really similar. What you do is, you know, you have one instance accepting the writes, we call it the primary server, and then every change ends up being like a, you know, so in SQLite speak, it's called the write ahead log. It essentially just captures the write, right? So, you know, what changed in the database, and then you just send this change to everywhere, they apply it to the database, and then that's it, right? So it's replication sort of has two components. One of these, the bootstrap thing, but the other one is purely just around like what is your write throughput.
So to be clear really quickly, like if I do go and distribute my database around the world, my reads are going to get really fast, page loads are going to get very fast, but like when I want my user to like, again, like submit an assignment, so I need to like save a record in a database, that request probably won't be impacted as much because it does still need to go to the central server.
Yeah, it needs to go. So it's something we want to fix, right? It's not I don't know if we want to get into it, but maybe we should. But yeah, so right now, as things are, you know, you're always going to write to the primary, and that is, and also with SQLite specifically, you know, write throughput doesn't really scale. So, you know, that's sort of the main downside of that approach. There are ways to fix it, and there's some really cool stuff happening in the SQLite ecosystem, basically to make it possible to write everywhere and then to synchronize those changes, something called CRDTs, and you know, there are other approaches as well, and that's super interesting approach, because like I think once you, you know, I mentioned, I think SQLite and Torso is really great for these personalization type of use cases, but those are reads, right? But once you actually have a database super close by, you know, it would be nice to have those local writes. And then, like I said, there are ways to fix it. You know, it's just a lot of engineering to get there.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like theoretically it makes a lot of sense, and you guys just have a lot of code to write. Because like theoretically it makes sense to me that like, okay, I've got like persistent storage near my user, and generally speaking, I don't care if like, So like that, just taking the example of boot dev, that user is completing lessons and mm-hmm. like I'm saving those to a database, but really in real time, the only person that cares about that is them. Like nobody else in the world needs to know that they're completing yes. lessons in real time. So like, it makes a lot of sense to me that, yeah, you could like do your reads and your writes to a local database, mm-hmm. as long as there's assurances that eventually, you know, it could even be 5 seconds or 10 seconds later, eventually that data will be synced up to the global database and then like replicated everywhere, so that when they, I don't know, travel to Italy and access boot dev from there, their mm-hmm. data will still be there. Or when they click over to the leaderboard, like mm-hmm. that the leaderboard will now update with like the global state of the world.
Yeah, absolutely. And so this is kind of the multiplayer scenario that, you know, a lot of people are working on. And like I said, I think there's cool stuff happening in the SQLite ecosystem. We initially, so there's like something I think really important that you mentioned, eventually. So, you know, eventual consistency is a thing. And it basically means that with this kind of a model, you know, you're guaranteed that at some point in time, all of these changes consolidate into something. And there is really no single view of the data. So, you know, it's great for scalability, for example. It's not always great for developer experience, right? So, you know, there's there's a lot of ways eventual consistency can screw you over. And, you know, the use case that you mentioned, a single user writing to, you know, their own data, you know, that's going to be fine. And there's ways to not use eventual consistency for that as well. But that, you know, at sort of broader perspective, we really wanted this thing to be transactional. We spent quite a lot of time thinking about like what should the consistency model be, and what are the transactional semantics. And basically what you want to do is if somebody writes to a database, they should probably see what they wrote, right? And that gets you in all of these things. So that's why we started with this simpler model, or maybe more limited model of writing to the primary. But what you get is transactional reads, right? So a lot of times people assume that Turso is eventually consistent. It is not. It's transactional in a sense that whenever you're doing a query, it's always a consistent snapshot in time, right? So there's replication delay, and that's going to be always there because there's geographic delay, right? That information just won't propagate immediately. But whenever you're doing a read or a query across, you know, all of your data, it's going to be a consistent snapshot of time, something that was transactionally committed. So that was something that we really felt that's super important from sort of developer experience perspective.
So like, let me make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. So for example, if I do a write to create, you know, an assignment completed record in my database, mm-hmm. and then I read, that record is guaranteed to be there. Is that the...
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
That's amazing because, like, to give listeners an example of what that would look like.
Yeah, so we are also cheating a little bit. Like I said, I have no problems with good hacks. So what we do, we also have something, you know, we call write delegation. So you can write to any replica, right? You know, we will just accept the write and just forward it to the primary. You know, so from an application, so that's also something we wanted to do. It's like, you write your application, you have a single URL, the HTTP URL, and, you know, you read and write, and, you know, we do the rest, right? So what we do, because, like, you know, if you think about it, you write to the primary, but if you read from a replica, right, so then, you know, what guarantees do you have? So what we do is if you write to a replica, we wait for the, you know, the replication to come back, right? So you always read your own write. But we think that's a super important thing from a, you know, just that, you know, I think it's around the same philosophy as a SQL, like, you don't have to care, like, we're just going to make it work for you, right? And then the cases which you mentioned around, like, to scale writes and so forth, like, we definitely need to do something. I think that's maybe something that also maybe people have, you know, it's easier to understand, like, you know, you wanted to write locally, now you're giving up something, right? And then you give up essentially this consistency guarantees.
Well, I tend to agree. That's like from a developer experience, super important. Also, just like the number of bugs I've seen that revolve around that sort of a problem are like, that's a huge source of bugs. So I want to like play back like what this would mean if you didn't do that from like a back-end developer's kind of experience is like, okay, I do a database write. So I create this record. If all that happened was that write goes to the primary and then my application server gets the response back and says write was successful. And then I immediately do a read on that data. If I hit a replica that's closer to me, maybe the write hasn't propagated from the master to the replica yet. So I could do a write in theory to the master and say, I created this thing. It's done. It's created. And then I do a read from the replica and it's not there. And that can be a huge source of bugs. So the fact that you guys have ensured that that doesn't happen, like just solves a lot of problems that could have otherwise become big issues.
We wanted to build a database we want to use as well, right? So, you know, we've all probably been there, like you have the UI and you do some operation, and then like even with when you use caching, for example, it's a typical problem, right? You know, you as a user, you did something, you think you had an sort of impact on the system state, and then all of a sudden you just see the old thing, right? And that's because caches wasn't invalidated or whatnot, right? So that's also something we really wanted to build in and like make the sort of simple and easy cases super simple. And then, you know, the, you know, if you need to do something more complex, then, you know, we should allow that, and but, you know, you're gonna pay a heavier price in using. So but I think like we were actually super worried when we initially announced this thing around write throughput as well, right? So, you know, and I think some of that maybe was because of the Scylla background, because writes are super important, you know, and it could do hundreds of thousands and even millions of writes per second and stuff like that. But in the end, like, as it turns out, you know, write throughput is really not a big problem for a lot of applications, like even bigger ones. And as I mentioned, like, because like what you anyway are going to do at some point is you start to shard your, you know, you have multiple databases. That's what we're going to do. Also make it super cheap and easy to have, you know, hundreds of databases. Because so one of the things which we didn't talk about, which, you know, maybe is also worth highlighting, SQLite is, as per the name, super lightweight, right? So you can have lots of SQLite databases on a machine. And maybe I should have mentioned that in the MySQL comparison as well. Like that's also like, but maybe it's like an internal thing, which, you know, it's hard to explain. But, you know, but at the end of the day, SQLite uses very little memory to host the data, so you can have lots of them.
Yeah, that's been my experience. Like I said, we actually do use SQLite on the back end of Boot Dev to power our SQL course. Mm-hmm. We're spinning up tiny little SQLite databases on the back end, like one per request.
Cool.
It's just that fast, you know?
Yeah, it is. Not a problem. Yes, it is. Yeah, it's insanely fast.
Cool. This has been so much fun. I'm glad we were able to get into all these topics, talk more about SQLite, talk more about Torso. Can you tell everyone where they can find the stuff you're doing and the stuff that Torso is doing in case they're interested and want to go further?
Yeah, so you should probably just go to torso.tech. That's the main website. Like, we're gonna just have all the information there, and just join our Discord as well. Like, we are, you know, always there, happy to answer questions. You know, and this the SQLite fork that we did is called libsql. You can find like all of that code is on GitHub. You know, it's rough around the edges as well. So happy to, like, you know, always happy to answer questions and help people, you know, dig into it more.
Fantastic. Is libsql written in C?
So libsql is written in C for the parts that SQLite is. So what we did with SQLite is, you know, and you don't really want to fork SQLite. So we did minimal modifications. We added some hooks and so forth. All of the cool stuff, the replication stuff, multi-tenancy stuff is written in Rust. So we essentially wrap around SQLite. So we kind of embed SQLite within libsql.
Because Rust has fairly simple ways to get C code.
Yeah, absolutely.
Into your binary, right? Cool. Yes. Very cool. Love to see it. Thanks again, Pekka. Anyone who's interested, check out torso.tech, and we'll talk to you later, man. Thanks again.
Thank you.